doing here this last 2 years. Good. Because when we talk about people like Hitler, we talk about Farage, we're talking about almost the total opposite, about using the same qualities, but using intention and using imagination. But what they're doing is taking an idea and projecting it out into the world, which of course is part of what we do. But there's no inner dialogue involved in that. They're not helping other people to explore their own experience. So their intention is to take their individual vision and to stamp it on the souls of or the hearts of the people they're in contact with, to make copies of themselves, effectively. Right. So what Nigel Farage or any political leader, like their charismatic leader, wants to do, is to create people that will just do as they're told and be on message and create the world, the vision that's coming out of the leader's heart. Now, ultimately, all this happens because human beings are innately creative beings. So all the time, in a way, we are creating, subliminally creating our vision of ourselves and our vision of the world. Now, we mostly do that through our it's an unconscious process. It's a very swift process, and mostly it has the function of creating stability in our world, so that we can live in a world so we can operate in a world that is relatively predictable. People vary about in terms of their personality how much predictability they need. You know, very rigid people have very, very rigid worlds, very rigid senses of self and very rigid senses of world, and can't tolerate much different. You know, if you come across people who are really, really sort of very routinized, you know, they do the same thing every day, eat the same meal, eventually you get into things like obsessive compulsive disorder, where you cannot tolerate any kind of difference. And so there's like a spectrum, human spectrum, really, between people who can be very, very fluid, and maybe for some people, fluidity and chaos is actually their stability. So that's at that one extreme end, where they can't tolerate anything that's got structure and order. And then at the other end, obsessive compulsive, everything has got to be ordered, you can't tolerate any degree of flexibility. But most of us are somewhere in the middle, depending on the kind of circumstances that are around us. It's always interesting, I think. That's why travel and stuff can be interesting sometimes. So when I plunge me into a totally unfamiliar environment, I completely swing to the obsessive compulsive disorder end, where I really kind of, I probably told you this before already, my first ever encounter at Delhi airport, it was like that. It was a total fucking mayhem. Well, and all I remember is clinging desperately to my red rucksack. Because keeping hold of Ali and Ali keeping hold of me, and us both keeping hold of our rucksacks and not letting go, because people are grabbing us, trying to take us off to their cousin's place, and there's like 20 of them, so you're kind of fighting it off. So that's where I'm right at that end. I don't have the screw flexibility. I'm keeping hold of my rucksack, I'm keeping hold of Ali, and I'm getting to the hotel that I've booked. You know, so at that moment, I'm in that total kind of, have no space even to notice the airport. I'm just, you know, in my rule for what's going to work, what's going to keep me safe. Now, in a sense, what's happened to us in our lives is that we, as kids, if you think of the experience of being a baby, babies are bombarded by the unfamiliar. Now, the thing for babies that really affects how much they can handle of that is how safe they feel, and therefore, in particular, their bond with their mother is like. Also, their bond with their father, but you know, the bond with mother is the first relationship. That's the intrauterine bond. Now, even that, you know, the experience of babyhood is, of course, also affected by what your life in the womb has been like. So if your experience of womb life and bond with mother is a good bond, then you have a feeling of safety and protection that enables you to tolerate the unfamiliar. You know, and of course the experience of being a baby, which none of us can really remember, is an extreme experience, right? So not only is the everything is unfamiliar and everything is coming at you all the time, but you're making enormous changes all the time. You know, time is speeded up in baby and early child life, right? Because your body's changing massively. Compare to adult bodies. You know, if you look at a baby, the way a baby changes over the first couple of weeks of its life, it's phenomenal. You know, go a month, my God, the changes in the body, the changes. So that sense of self changing and world changing is enormous. And this is, in a way, the place where we really learn about our sense of self and our sense of the greater world. Now, if we feel very secure, and if we're surrounded by a world in which we're protected, well, of course, that growth can be relatively smooth. But for most of us, it isn't like that. And even if we've got good parents and good relationships, it's not necessarily like that. Because one of the things that baby time is speeded up time. Adults and babies live in different dimensions of time. 10 minutes to a baby can be like a year, or 10 years, right? To an adult, of course, it's particularly to a busy parent who's just got a new baby, 10 minutes is nothing. Half an hour is nothing. So babies in the space of 10 minutes, or even 5 minutes sometimes, can have really significant experiences of abandonment or loss that are completely imperceptible to their carers. So the big thing that affects us as human beings is this place of security and fear. And this massively affects our capacity to imagine, our capacity to will, our capacity to imagine. So if, for example, we start, and the balance really of security and fear, or love and fear, I suppose, in our life, affect both the sense of the self, image of ourself we create, and also the image of our world. And so therefore it has effect with how much of our imagination and our will is directed towards, if you like, moving smoothly outwards, you know, bringing out what is intimate of us into the world. The more sense of security or feeling met by ourselves, met by the world, and loved as ourselves we have, the easier it is for us to manifest our visions. The more fear we've experienced, the more disjuncture or abandonment we've experienced, the more of our creativity we have to employ to defend against that, to create safety ourselves. Now, every human being has to do this. I mean, even in ideal circumstances, as I say, because of the difference between baby time and adult time, a certain part of our creativity and our intention is devoted to protecting ourselves. And that's not wrong, that's a natural thing. We need to do that. We need to create shape and boundary and form that can keep us safe in a world. Because as you know, we're starting off as babies in quite a small world. As we grow and develop, as we start to be able to stand up and move, the world gets bigger and bigger, our bodies get bigger, our different senses kicking, different capacities kicking. We learn to talk, we learn language, we learn to hear differently. You know, we come, of course, with all these inner capacities that are already there, but haven't yet been matched up to the world. A friend of mine once had two twin daughters, and one of the things that was interesting for her with the twin daughters is that very early on, is that before they could talk English, they had their own language. So they would talk in this. She was fascinated by it in a way, because they would talk together. They couldn't talk to her, they couldn't talk to her husband, but they could talk to each other in a language that had phonemes, that obviously had structure, that had some, and they clearly kind of were having conversations. They weren't just babbling at each other. And she said, what she noticed as the girls got older is like they stopped using the private language and learned English, learned another language. But sometimes under stress, they would revert when they were to each other into the baby language. That was obviously there underneath. So babies are not blank slates, and because actually what happens, and we'll talk later, more about this a bit later, but so in a sense what we're looking at is, if you like, the human soul coming into existence with all kinds of capacities, but coming into a new experience, coming into a new family, coming into a new set of circumstances, coming into a particular time, moving, if you like, from the formless worlds or the formless experience into formed experience, and I mean that obviously happening initially at conception and entry and the growth of the growth of the fertilized embryo in the womb, but then after birth, happening in the social world of human life and biological life, you know, and being learning about separateness and togetherness. And so there's a whole lot of stuff that happens to us there, and so when we are addressing these ideas or looking at our will and imagination, what we're looking at really is something that isn't neutral. You know, you can't just decide to work on your will, work on your imagination. What you find is that these things have their own life. You know, it's a bit like you try and fast for a day. You discover that what we call willpower. The will is a deep energy in us, right? And it's related to survival. It's related to keeping us safe, keeping our world safe. So when we change, particularly when we change major things, like eating is a major thing, because eating is about survival. It's about life. It's about contact. It's about all kinds of things. So we're trying to change something like that. We activate something that's very powerful. So what happens is, you in that instant, you have a conscious intention to fast for a day, but you at a certain point your will kicks in and you eat a proper meal.
It's one day.
I know, but it's powerful, right? It's powerful. So
it's not my fault.
When we talk about transformation, we have to look at engaging our imagination and our wills together, because it real change comes when the will shifts. You know, when you can envisage something differently, and the will shifts normally when we've worked on ourselves and released the conditions that keep that particular intention and that deep will in place. Now all the exercises that we've done, when we come into the body, we come in, get present, we're getting present, if you like, to our will, our imagination, to our sense of ourself and our sense of the world. And then the particular intentionality that we're working with when we do these exercises, we're working with our will and imagination to open us to something different, a different possibility. So this sense of the descent into Anuven, or descent into the deep, is the intention to go underneath or beyond the conditioned places of will and imagination. And the prisoner that we find in the beginning of the poem, the prisoner is our conditioned will, is our conditioned imagination. But within our human nature, there is a deeper quality. So this song of the prisoner that's wanting to be free is the potential within us of something that wants to go beyond our limits. You know, why do we sit in a course like this? Why do we try out anything new? There's all kinds of reasons probably, but probably the deepest reason is we want to go beyond our limits. We want to find new ways of expression, new possibilities. And so in order to do that, we have to come descend into the deep place where we find the prisoner. The great idea, great image of the you get in that poem is it's a paradoxical image, because you go into the mound, you go into the castle of the mound, but it's also like going into the sea, because actually the prisoner is on an island surrounded by the sea. So the prisoner in the deep place, I mean, the sea in a way represents the depth, I suppose, and the deeper part of human nature. And on an island there somewhere, there's a prisoner. And on that same island, there's also the cauldron of inspiration. So it's a serious kind of hint about in the places where the place where we find the sword of light, which is in a way the will, the place where we find the cauldron of inspiration, which is the imagination, is the same place where the prisoner is. And in a way, that's a real important way of saying that actually these deep qualities of inspiration or of creativity and will are found just in our own heart, in the place where we are also imprisoned, because the chaining of our the chains around us are self-created chains, but they were created for good reasons, right? So they were created, so these chains, these limits we place on ourselves, this separation we create around ourselves, is because we have experienced danger and abandonment. And that, without blaming anybody about that, right? You know, it's sort of, you know, we're back with baby time, adult time. And if, of course, we've lived in disorderly or difficult environments, that sense of abandonment can be even kind of stronger. Now, abandonment and difficulty is actually a good thing. It's not an easy thing, but it's a good thing because it develops both will and creativity. You know, one of the things that, and you see it much maybe more these days sometimes, people who have lived in very pampered surroundings, particularly people who have lived with lots of money, and there's something flabby about their wills, and they have reactive imaginations. They can't, you know, I think of a friend of mine who trained as a psychotherapist with me years ago. Lovely woman, very, very talented woman, but was in this situation. She spent all her life wandering the planet, never doing anything, never got to be a therapist, done all kinds of courses, but can't activate anything for herself because she had these incredibly indulgent parents. She's got loads of cash, and she wastes her life. She's got nothing to struggle against, nothing to kind of, you know, if anything's difficult, she just moves on. She just, you know, she's came to Glastonbury 6 months ago, so she's flogging, she's renting out a house because she's obviously doing a thing, she's moving on again. And so there's something that's quite important about this, you know, a lot of stuff sometimes, particularly around child rearing and early rearing, is that, you know, the guilt that's inflicted upon parents for having to be perfect. First thing is when it can't be, because baby time and adult time is so different. But secondly, you know, you actually need to experience difficulty in order to develop your capacity, develop the capacity to will and imagine. And if you haven't got that, these capacities are really undeveloped in you. It gives you quite a big problem in some ways.
You don't need to have money. You just have to look at all the pampered kids whose parents helicopter them.
Oh yeah. Yeah, totally. No, it's a really bizarre. It's a really bizarre thing in modern child rearing. It's created people who remain dependent all their lives. You know, there's no. It's a very kind of weird thing, I think.
But experiencing those difficulties or those feelings allows us to exercise creativity and will.
Yeah.
In a limiting way, it gives us structures to keep us safe, which we then have to try and.
Yeah. And the creating structures, creating limits is important, right? Because actually, if you like, creativity can only happen within a vessel. That's where the image of Kelsey is a cauldron. Yeah. It's a contained space. You can try and cook a meal in a sort of leaky cauldron, and of course you have a mess everywhere. Nothing kind of, so there has to be this contained place that is like a kind of pressure cooker that enables something new to emerge, because creativity is also always about death and resurrection. You know, so as we end this training this weekend, something dies and something is born. You know, extraordinarily in your life at the moment, your mum has finally died, and so that's sad and complicated, which why it isn't just fantastic, unlike the idiots who said that.
Yeah.
Sad and complicated and all the rest of it. And at the same time, already there's that sense of relief, and something new will emerge. Now that's all, and that's the fundamental thing that happens around any creative act. Right? It's always death, and it's always death and resurrection. And any new evocation of the will involves a changing of that deep will. So something always has to die in that, for the will to become freed in some ways. You know, the problem with as adults is the fixation of our will. So will operating in stereotypic movements, and our imagination reflecting that. So the kind of experiences, you know, that I'm trying to keep myself safe from, in a way, often are things that happened to me when I was very small. And often there isn't much of an alignment between that and what's actually going on. You know, so the extent to which I can kind of get present into myself now, my conditions now, and the actual conditions I'm around, and to match that up with the inner experience of will and creativity. So, which is really what we're doing when we use these exercises of getting present and listening and experiencing what's coming out of the depth, and then coming out and opening our senses into the world. What we're doing is realigning. It's an act of realigning will and imagination. Okay? It's often why these exercises are disturbing. Because what they do is they disturb, they're intended to. We're going down into these very, working with the body and the senses, going down into these deep places, and working with images that have the intention to create change, to create difference. And so that disturbs, it takes us into, it makes the world a bit shaky. Makes our sense of ourselves shaky, but also the sense of the world around us. And that's kind of what happens when we realign our will and imagination like this. And the importance of the poem or the Tree of Life are these are just models for reminding us of that process, that other people have studied this. So that's, you know, we look at something like these models that come out of the Middle Ages, you know, they're there for, you know, 1,000 years back or something. They're just helpful things because they said some of this knowledge has been lost from current society, but it also reminds us that this is something basic to human nature. No matter what the conditions around you are, no matter what the society you're in, this is always something that happens to human beings. That because it's so part of primeval bodily experience of coming into the world. Now, one of the problems we have in current society is because we live in a much more controlled world than they did in the Middle Ages. Although, I mean, there was still quite a stratified world, but there were no cameras for one thing. You know, so our technology has enabled us to create a much more standardized world. So one of the particular external energies that happens to us when we try and manifest our creativity is we meet a world currently that is really trying to create an unified global world where everybody's life is controlled, that really isn't interested in, is only interested in the expression of creativity when it can be shown to have a commercially effective outcome for the people who control the means of production, to use a Marxist phrase. Global capitalism has, and I'm fine if your creativity happens to be aligned to something, you're going to do brilliantly because you'll have that massive support of the society behind you. But of course, mostly creativity is more disturbing than that, because actually what creativity actually is, when you really pay attention to that deep will and deep imagination, it's not interested in yoking itself up to anybody else's agenda. It's really looking at the particular, it's like a sort of fountain inside yourself, that or a fountain of fire even maybe inside yourself, that is wanting to express itself in its own way. So that place when you get into your groove, when you know you've got your mojo going, is when it's very personal, very particular to you and your particular abilities, your particular sense of yourself. So it's not, generally speaking, if it lines up with that kind of wider societal thing, normally that's accidental. You know, and so normally, as well as the internal resistance that you'll find that will be about the places of fear inside yourself, what you also have to, in terms of this image of the wall that Fern was talking about, what you often encounter is the wall of society that wants people to do as they're told. And that's sort of hinted there somewhere in that bit of the poem. It talks about the 6,000 people who can't speak, where they can't parley because they can't independently speak. They're silent, they're mute. And actually, the thing that the bards above all were about was about expression, about speaking. This is the idea of the seventh sense of Taliesin that we were looking at last time, where that you have the, you know, the five senses of the body, the sixth sense of consciousness, and then the seventh sense that is like emergence. It's emergence of creativity. That's the will and the imagination breaking through. That is a sensory expressive experience. So, we're at Apis 12, so we'll have another sensory experience and have our lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Come back at 2 o'clock. Sixth sense is a sense of knowing, right? It's the sort of, it's the five senses, and then knowing, direct knowing is the sixth.
And that's when Gnostic?
That's the word Gnostic, that's where the phrase Gnostic. Gnosis is the one that knows.